Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, from the states of Maine to Hawaii, students walked out of school Wednesday to protest gun violence in the United States. The nationwide demonstration is part of a student movement against gun violence created after last month's mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. 17 students and teachers were killed in an attack there on February 14th. The event includes about 3,000 protests across the country. Some students planned roadside demonstrations to honor shooting victims and protest violence. Others held demonstrations in school sports centers or on football fields. In the states of Massachusetts, Georgia, and Ohio, students went to the state houses to pressure lawmakers for new and stronger rules on guns. Empower, the youth wing of the Women's March, loosely organized the activism. The group urged students to leave class at 10 in the morning local time for 17 minutes. Each minute represents one person who died in the recent school shooting in Parkland. The group also called on students to make demands of their lawmakers, including an assault weapons ban. The group said on its website, "Our elected officials must do more than tweet thoughts and prayers in response to this violence." Each community was urged to shape its own protest. Parents and teachers in many areas worked together to organize activities that would be right for different ages of students. At Case Elementary School in Akron, Ohio, a group of 10 and 11-year-olds designed their walkout after youth marches for civil rights in 1963. Case instructors said students lined a sidewalk along a nearby road carrying posters with the names of Parkland victims. Students in Massachusetts demonstrated outside offices of the gunmaker Smith & Wesson. They called on the gunmaker to help reduce gun violence. Officials at Boston Public Schools held a whole day of observance Wednesday. They organized several activities to provide healthy and safe ways for students to express their opinions and concerns. Several American companies showed support for the walkouts. Media conglomerate Viacom suspended programming on MTV, BET, and all its other networks for 17 minutes during the action. It also permitted students to temporarily take control of MTV's social media sites. But school administrators across the country had mixed reactions to students' activism. Some have praised students for taking a stand. Others threatened to take measures against students for school absences. Districts in Sayreville, New Jersey, and Maryland's Harford County drew criticism this week when they said students could face punishment for leaving class. In Pensacola, Florida, Superintendent Malcolm Thomas ordered an in-school gathering instead. He warned students that they could discuss voting and mental health issues, but not guns. He also said political signs would not be permitted. Free speech supporters readied for battle. The American Civil Liberties Union said schools cannot legally punish students for the political nature of their message. In Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Texas, some lawyers said they will provide free legal help to students who are punished.
Britain will expel 23 Russian diplomats in answer to a chemical attack on a Russian double agent and his daughter in the city of Salisbury, England. Prime Minister Theresa May announced the expulsion decision Wednesday. May said the attack was an unlawful use of force by Russia against Britain. She also said Britain would suspend high-level talks with the Russian Federation and withdraw an invitation to the Russian foreign minister to visit the country. Russian officials have denied that Russia was involved in the chemical attack. A spokesperson called Britain's actions unacceptable, unjustified, and short-sighted. The spokesperson warned Britain to expect the Russian government to answer with measures of its own. Britain's restrictions against Russia come after an attack earlier this month on Sergei Skripal, age 66, and his 33-year-old daughter, Yulia. Sergei Skripal is a former Russian military intelligence official. In the 1990s, he secretly told the British government about Russian spies working in Europe. In 2004, Russia charged Skripal with treason and put him in jail. But he was freed in a spy exchange deal in 2010. Skripal settled in Britain. His daughter was visiting him there. On March 4th, the Skripals were found at a shopping center in the southern English city of Salisbury. They could not be woken. The father and daughter were taken to the hospital. They remain there in serious condition. May has said the Skripals were poisoned with a nerve agent Russia developed in the 1980s. The chemical was designed to be used in bombs during military operations. The Prime Minister asked Russian officials to explain if they were responsible for the attack or if they had lost control of the poison. But, May said, Russian officials did not take her question seriously. May said the 23 expelled Russian diplomats must leave Britain within 1 week. And, she said, British officials will closely watch for travelers to Britain who might be a threat. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
A study has found that false news stories posted on Twitter travel much faster and reach far more people than true ones. The new research also showed that people, not automated robots, sometimes called bots, were mostly responsible for spreading false news. The study was done by researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab. Results were reported in the publication Science. It was one of the biggest efforts yet to study the effects of social media on the spread of real and false news. Twitter cooperated with the study. The company gave the MIT Media Lab access to its data and provided money for the project. The team researched stories posted on Twitter since the service began in 2006. It identified and examined more than 126,000 stories tweeted by about 3 million people through the end of 2016. The stories chosen had been investigated by various independent fact-checking organizations to decide whether they were true, false, or a mix of both. Nearly two-thirds of stories were found to be false, while about one-fifth were true. The rest were mixed. The researchers compared the speed and reach of stories found to be false to those verified as true.
Sarush Visugi is a data scientist with MIT's Media Lab who helped lead the project.
What we found was that false news spreads further, faster, and broader than true news in every category of information.
Visugi said the three false stories that traveled the farthest and fastest were about a Muslim guard called a hero in the 2015 Paris bombings, an Iraq war veteran finishing as runner-up to Caitlyn Jenner for a Courage Award, and a show of The Simpsons with a storyline back in 2000 about a Trump presidency. The study showed that the average false story took about 10 hours to reach 1,500 Twitter users, compared to about 60 hours for the truth. False information was found to reach 35% more people than true news. While true stories almost never got retweeted to more than 1,000 people, the top 1% of false ones reached as many as 100,000 people.
Visugi said the speed and reach of false news stories was especially intense when related to politics. False political news spread faster and to more people than stories about terrorism, natural disasters, science, and other subjects, the study found. The researchers noted increases in false political stories during the 2012 and 2016 American presidential races. Twitter, Facebook, and other social media companies have come under pressure from U.S. lawmakers and international regulators to do more to prevent the spread of false news. U.S. officials have accused Russia of using social media to affect public opinion on issues and trying to interfere in the 2016 U.S. election. The use of automated robots to post on Twitter and other services is one area that has received heavy criticism. In a tweet sent March 1st, Twitter co-founder and CEO Jack Dorsey admitted widespread misuse of the service by both robots and humans. "We aren't proud of how people have taken advantage of our service or our inability to address it fast enough," he wrote. Twitter says it has sought help from outside experts to better deal with the problem. Dorsey personally promised to hold ourselves publicly accountable towards progress. Social media companies have also experimented with computer programs and hired more humans in an effort to identify and remove false stories.
Vasugi said the study found that robot-linked accounts pushed out true and false stories equally. This means human users were more directly responsible for sharing false news. One reason false news might be more surprising is it goes against people's expectations of the world, he said. If someone makes up a rumor that goes against what they expected, you are more likely to pass it forward.
Study co-author Deb Roy is a former media scientist at Twitter who now runs MIT's Laboratory for Social Machines. He says the study proves that false news is clearly still winning out over truth on Twitter. He added that the results raise many questions about what methods should be used to help prevent the problem in the future. Roy believes this will likely involve combined efforts between social media companies, news publishers, and users themselves to fight false news. Let's not take it as our destiny that we have entered into a post-truth world from which we will not emerge, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the early weeks of 1863, the American Civil War took a new political direction. President Abraham Lincoln had announced the Emancipation Proclamation. That measure freed the slaves in the rebel states of the South, though Lincoln's words fell on deaf ears. Yet no longer was the Civil War a struggle just to save the Union. It had become a struggle for human freedom. There was a change on the military side of the war, too. President Lincoln named a new commander for the Union's Army of the Potomac. This was the force that would try again to capture the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant describe events during the spring of 1863.
General Joe Hooker was the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced General Ambrose Burnside when Burnside suffered a terrible defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the end of 1862. Burnside had replaced General George McClellan when McClellan kept refusing to obey President Lincoln's orders. Hooker had 130,000 men. They were well trained and well supplied. The Confederate force opposing Hooker's was under the command of General Robert E. Lee. Lee had only about 60,000 men. They did not have good equipment, and their supplies were low. But their fighting spirit was high. They had defeated the Union Army before. They were sure they could do it again.
Lee's army still held strong defensive positions along high ground south of Fredericksburg. This was almost halfway between the capitals of the opposing sides, Washington and Richmond. General Hooker did not plan to make the same mistake which General Burnside made at Fredericksburg. Burnside had thrown his army against Lee's defensive positions 6 times. Each time, the Confederates pushed them back easily. In one day of fighting, more than 12,000 Union soldiers were killed or wounded. General Hooker had rebuilt the Army of the Potomac. Now he was ready to carry out his plan against General Lee. Hooker left half his men at Fredericksburg in front of Lee's army. He would move the other half into position behind Lee's army. If Lee turned to meet him, the troops at Fredericksburg would attack. The Confederate army would be caught between two powerful forces. Lee would have to withdraw or lose his army.
Hooker moved around past the end of Lee's line. Then he turned and started marching back behind it. It was a hard march through thick woods and across rough hills and valleys. The country was so wild that it was called the Wilderness. On the last day of April 1863, the Union force reached Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a crossroads near the edge of the Wilderness. The next day, the soldiers would be in open country. There, General Hooker could make the best use of his men. Hooker was extremely pleased. Everything was going as he had planned. He told his officers, "I have Lee in one hand and Richmond in the other." The next day, Union soldiers began moving out of Chancellorsville and the Wilderness. They did not get far. They ran into several thousand Confederate soldiers. Lee had sent them to slow the Union force.
The Confederate force was weak. General Hooker's officers believed they could smash through it without difficulty. They did not get a chance to try. Hooker sent new orders: break off the fight, return to Chancellorsville, put up defensive positions. Hooker's officers were shocked. They protested. Hooker stood firm. He said, "Lee must fight me on my own ground." Robert E. Lee could not understand why the Union force had returned to Chancellorsville, but he was happy it did. Now he had time to prepare his men for battle.
Lee met that night with his top general, Stonewall Jackson. They discussed the best way to attack the Union force. The center of the Union line was strong. The right side was not. Jackson was sure he could get around behind it. Lee asked Jackson how many men he would take. "All of them," Jackson answered, 28,000. This meant Lee would have only 14,000 men to face General Hooker. If the Union force attacked before Stonewall Jackson got into position, Lee could not possibly hold it back. Lee was taking a huge chance. He thought about it for a moment. Then he told Jackson to get started.
Jackson's men began to leave the next morning. Union soldiers watched as they marched away. General Hooker thought Lee was withdrawing. It took Jackson only half a day to get behind the Union force. He spent a few more hours putting his troops into position. Then he attacked. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The right end of the Union force was not prepared for an attack. The soldiers could not believe their eyes when they saw Confederate troops running out of the woods behind them. Many Union soldiers were killed or wounded. Thousands fled. The sun went down. The fighting continued under a bright moon. The Confederate troops kept moving forward. The Union troops kept falling back. One Northern soldier wrote later, "Darkness was upon us. Jackson was upon us. And fear was upon us."
Jackson seemed to be everywhere. He rode his horse among his men, urging them forward. He would not let the Union force escape. As Jackson and some of his officers rode into a cleared area of the woods, shots rang out. The bullets came from Confederate guns. The Confederate soldiers thought they were firing on Union officers. Jackson fell from his horse. Two bullets had smashed his left arm. Another bullet had hit his right hand. He was hurried to the back of the line. A doctor quickly cut off his left arm and stopped the heavy bleeding. Jackson seemed to get better. Then he developed pneumonia. He was unconscious most of the time. He seemed to dream of battle and shouted commands to his officers. Then he grew quiet. He opened his eyes and said, "Let us pass over the river and rest in the shade of the trees." The great Confederate general Stonewall Jackson was dead.
While Jackson lay dying, the Battle of Chancellorsville continued. Robert E. Lee's Confederate army was much smaller than Joe Hooker's Union army. But for 5 days, Lee kept part of his army moving between Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. Wherever the Union army attacked, Lee quickly added more men to his lines. The Union army could not break through. The fighting was taking place on the south side of the Rappahannock River. The Union army's supply lines were on the north side. Spring rains were beginning to make the Rappahannock rise. General Hooker did not want to get trapped without food and ammunition, so he ordered his men back across the river.
The South had won the Battle of Chancellorsville. Robert E. Lee was sure of that. Once again, he had forced back the Army of the Potomac. But the Union Army was not hurt seriously. New soldiers would soon take the place of those lost in battle. Lee, however, would find it more difficult to replace his soldiers. The South was running out of manpower. Every Confederate army needed men, more and more men. Yet fewer and fewer Southern boys were willing to become soldiers. Anti-war movements were, in fact, active in both the North and South. There were a number of protests against the military draft. Some turned violent. In the North, a political party was created to oppose the Civil War. Leaders of this peace party were called Copperheads. They got the name because they wore a copper penny showing the head of an Indian. That will be our story in our next program on the Civil War.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.